The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return once again to the August 2021 edition of Our State magazine, which celebrates North Carolina. Picture of a glass Pepsi bottle on the cover and some peanuts. The theme this month was Proud of the Peanut. We're going to read about some other things that we're proud of in North Carolina. We're going to start off with Lowe's Hardware, the little hardware store that could. When a Wilkes County farmer opened his namesake hardware store a century ago in North Wilkesboro, no one could have predicted that Lowe's would go from selling snuff and horse collars to becoming one of the largest home improvement chains in the world. A little picture here of the North Wilkesboro hardware store, and that's what it says, North Wilkesboro Burl Hardware on it. Above the top, it says Fairbanks Morse Pumps and Alcoa Aluminum Roofing. And there's a roofing place that's next door. It's an old two-story brick building. It looks pretty awful. But that's where it all started. The scents in classic hardware stores were unmistakable. Sawdust and paint and fertilizer and new tires, all mingling together. Every aisle of the hardware store offered a new scent, a new tool, a new memory. Those places sold everything from 12-penny nails and bolts by the pound to plumbing supplies and gardening tools, from galvanized wash tubs and assorted socket wrenches to oil lamps, hand saws, and even the old flexible flyer sleds. Yours truly owned one of them. Remember the wooden floors that creaked with every step? The wall of tools with hammers and saws and mysterious handheld contraptions? The shrill sound of the key grinding machine? Remember running your fingers through a bin full of washers or wing nuts? Whether you went to buy grass seed in the spring, a rake in the fall, or a snow shovel in the winter, a visit to your local hardware store made a memory. They were the Swiss Army knives of retail. That's the history of Lowe's Home Improvement, which L.S. Lowe started in 1921 as Lowe's North Wilkesboro Hardware, a relative cracker box of a downtown store on C Street. Although Lowe was the founding namesake of what would become one of the world's largest home improvement chains, the affable Wilkes County farmer and businessman had little to do with transforming his small-town hardware store into the corporate giant that Lowe's has become. When the 42-year-old Lowe opened his store, he was content to sell the general merchandise that most rural hardware stores of that era were known for. During those early years, shoppers may not have found kitchen sinks and patio furniture in the 3,500-square-foot store, but if they needed dry goods, groceries, a roll of barbed wire, a keg of nails, or some other miscellaneous hardware item, or even a tin of snuff, Lowe had them covered. After Lowe died in 1940, his daughter, Ruth Lowe Buchan, that's B-U-C-H-A-N, inherited the business and then sold it to her brother, Jim Lowe. But it was Ruth and her mother, Floy Elizabeth Lowe, who ran the family business during the early 40s while Jim was serving in the Army. The two women ran the hardware store as best they could in the constricted economy of the war years, writes author Denny McIntyre in No Place Like Lowe's, A History of the Company. They had to get used to shortages, to unreliable suppliers, to ration books, coupons, and stamps. They had to get used to telling people, no, it wasn't much fun or very profitable. Like many businesses, Lowe's North Wilkesboro Hardware was just hanging on. What may have ultimately saved the company was love. When Ruth Lowe married Carl Buchan Jr., the wheels of change and growth began to turn. Like Jim Lowe, Buchan enlisted in the Army, but he was given an honorable discharge after suffering a foot injury in 1943. Suddenly, he needed a job. Lowe, still in the Army, made Buchan an offer. If Buchan took a complete inventory of the store and Buchan paid Lowe the equivalent amount in cash, the two would be 50-50 partners. The stock consisted of notions, dried goods, horse collars, harnesses, snuff, produce, groceries, small miscellaneous hardware, and building materials, Buchan later recalled. All told, the inventory amounted to about $12,500. After buying into the family business, Buchan assumed management of the store and immediately decided to sell off the stock except for the heavy hardware and building materials. Buchan foresaw what many other merchants did not. When the war ended and millions of soldiers returned home, they would need houses. A building boom was about to erupt, and Buchan was positioning Lowe's to be part of it. Among those millions of soldiers coming home was Jim Lowe, who initially embraced his brother-in-law's vision for the company. But he soon turned to other business interests, including starting the Lowe's Foods supermarket chain. Meanwhile, in 1949, Lowe's opened its first branch store north of North Wilkesboro in Sparta. 3 years after that, Buchan bought out Jim Lowe's interest in the company. I was completely on my own for the first time in my life, Buchan would later recall. Predictions were that I would fail. My trade connections said that I would not last beyond 90 days. The crystal ball gazers were wrong. About 90 days later, Buchan opened another store, this one in Asheville, then another. Then two more. Lowe's stores were multiplying, and with them, so were sales, to the tune of $30.7 million in 1960. Buchan died in October 1960 at age 44, but his plan for the growth of Lowe's was in place. The company continued to blossom without him at the helm, going on to become the largest hardware chain in the country before being surpassed by the Home Depot. It remains the second largest, and no other chain is even close. In 2003, Lowe's relocated its corporate headquarters to Mooresville, but its presence is still felt in North Wilkesboro. From the Lowe's exhibit at the Wilkes Heritage Museum to the many Lowe's employees who settled there and never left. The museum exhibit showcases a few remnants from the store's early days, the first cash register, vintage photographs, old ledgers, an apron worn by Lowe's employees. It's not a lot, but it's enough to fuel the community's pride. To have something of that nature here in Wilkes County and go worldwide is tremendous, says Jennifer Furr, executive director of the Wilkes Heritage Museum. Most people would never believe something like that could come from a small town in North Carolina. Written by Jimmy Tomlin. And there's a picture here of Carl Buchan Jr., obviously taken a long time ago. He's in a dark suit and white shirt and tie, and he's both hands up in the air, and he's lecturing at a lectern, and there's a big map of West Virginia, Kentucky, and that area behind him, kind of covered up by his body. I would have been interested to know what happened to Lowe's Foods since the man named Jim Lowe started it. But they don't tell us. Anyway, the next article is Bowls of Paradise. North Carolinians have always known that our pottery tradition is something to celebrate, as its dishware in simple shapes and earthy colors captivates a growing fan base, Asheville's East Fork Potteries, letting the rest of the world in on our secret. Written by Katie Shantz. Lots of pictures of pottery bowls here on the, surrounding the title of the article and the first page. The first time I took a sip of hot coffee from The Mug, I became an East Fork pottery believer, an instant fan, a fan of dishware. Yes, The Mug, my mug, was a deep blue-green, a color called Night Swim that had an air of mystery. It was hefty to hold, smooth to the touch. It had perfectly imperfect speckles and a thin, unglazed rim. It held the exact right amount of coffee. I never wanted to drink out of another mug again. Soon after, my mom texted me, "What do you want for Christmas this year?" "Plates," I responded immediately. "You're really going for it," she wrote back. "You're adulting." Okay, so maybe that was the source of my obsession, a desire to own a beautiful set of dishes rather than an assortment of random plates and bowls I'd been collecting since college. To feel like I had it all together, at least in the kitchen, The Mug was my first real taste of quality. But still, I thought, Mom needed to see pottery from East Fork up close to hold it in order to understand why it was special. Dishware, exactly, or actually, isn't boring. She was just an East Fork fan who didn't know it yet. A dream began to take shape. A full dish set from East Fork. My own dish set. Settings for every occasion. I envisioned a dinner party with a fabulous array of plates on the table. A collection I could gradually add to. Something I could build. In the shadow of the Blue Ridge Mountains, in an old Madison County farm yard, down a dirt drive known as East Fork, smoke puffed out of a hand-built wood-fired brick kiln. For Alex Matisse, the pottery being fired was his first true dream being realized. But there were even bigger dreams to come. Alex, the great-grandson of French modernist Henri Matisse, had long been drawn to pottery over painting. "Since the fourth grade, I gravitated toward it," he said. "I didn't feel like I was held to the same standards as if I were a painter. I was free from that. I've always loved the physicality of it, the process behind it. It's so much more than just drawing." At 18, he left his home in Massachusetts to attend Guilford College in Greensboro, where one day he wandered into the ceramic studio. With the help of a professor who showed him the richness of North Carolina's pottery tradition, he discovered just how much he loved the medium. How serendipitous, he thought, that he'd come to this state to go to college. When he'd blown through all the classes he could take in his program, he began working for Matt Jones, a potter outside of Asheville. Soon, Alex dropped out of school to become Jones's full-time apprentice. There was something about walking into that workshop, Alex says. There was a wood stove, and it was smoky. This workshop was damp and had a dirt floor to keep the clay moist and drying slowly. And it was just very dark and visceral and nostalgic, and I loved it. And then there was so much around the making of pottery that I loved, too, because I've always liked working with my hands. There was wood to chop, bricks to clean, clay to make, and it just felt like such a full life to live. In 2009, Alex bought a former tobacco farm in rural Madison County and, with an admittedly romantic notion in mind, set out to follow his teacher's footsteps by building his own wood-fired kiln. There he met his future wife, Connie, in nearby Marshall. With her help, he laid his kiln brick by brick, and in 2011, they officially launched East Fork. Alex was throwing every vessel, made with iron-rich North Carolina clay by hand, and selling the decorative embellished stoneware to collectors. In 2013, fellow potter John Weigland joined the fold, and the three friends and founders contemplated their master plan, what they would make, what they could build together, we did have a vision, Alex says. We had already started to picture something much larger. We were imagining how we could breathe life into the next generation of U.S. manufacturing. Eventually, we decided to launch a line, and we took out a loan to buy a gas kiln. Going from wood to gas was sort of like going from driving around in a Conestoga wagon to buying a Tesla. It felt like a huge investment at the time, but the decision was really pivotal. With their new kiln, they began to simplify their pottery, to shift their aesthetic to something more practical, less fragile and delicate, something yet somehow softer and more muted, with matte glazes and light speckles due to the iron in the clay. Plates, bowls, and cups that were modern but substantial. On the morning of their very first kiln opening, the trio eagerly awaited for crowds to queue up for the new line of undecorated pottery. Usually people show up to a kiln opening at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you've got 40 or 50 people ready to come in. And nobody showed up to ours, Alex says. So 9 o'clock passes, then 10. Finally around 11 o'clock, one little car comes bumping up the dirt driveway. He grins. But obviously, that only lasted for so long. 10 years since East Fork's launch, it's an understatement to say that the public conversation around the pottery is buzzier. The company has grown from its three founders to a team of more than 100 and moved from that old tobacco farm in Madison County to a 14,500-square-foot light-filled factory in Asheville, plus a sunny storefront downtown and one in Atlanta. They transitioned from shaping each design on a wheel by hand, as they had for years, to taking advantage of a variety of machines and molds, which help shorten production time and accommodate always rising demand. That no-show kiln opening is now just an isn't-that-funny story from the past. East Fork's dishware quickly built a cult following, which has grown so much that it can hardly be called, and although some fans do, or rather are decidedly still cult-like in their devotion, Connie's irreverent fun and colorful creative branding and her authentic behind-the-curtain Instagram posts have endeared the masses, while national press from the New York Times, Vogue, and other media outlets alerted those who hadn't already caught on by word of mouth. Before East Fork upped its production capabilities, huge restocks of items like the mug, its official name, would sell out in minutes, creating a cycle of ever-increasing demand for more. It wasn't on purpose. Connie, Alex, and John were just doing their best to keep up, but it seemed like no matter how many mugs they made, it was never enough. When they finally launched a version of the mug made on their new machines, there was a 3,000-person waiting list. Now there's no more waiting. Their dishware is produced year-round in earthy, neutral colors like eggshell, morel, and panna cotta, while brighter colors from taro, a muted pastel purple, to tequila sunrise, a warm orange, pop up seasonally for a limited time. But growth hasn't come without challenges. I remember being in labor with our second child, and I was bouncing on an exercise ball, responding to customer emails, Connie says. At the time, I remember thinking to myself, I have to be doing this. Now, a legendarily friendlier customer service team take care of emails and messages from new fans and, yes, seasoned fanatics. Remember, cult-like customers have been known to send dozens of emails in a day. A woman recently showed up and milled around East Fork storefront every single day for a week, and a collector bought an armful of special two-handled mugs, which, within 10 minutes, she posted on the East Fork Community Trade account of Instagram. Yes, that's a thing. The enthusiasm is a reality that Connie and Max haven't quite been able to wrap their heads around. Sometimes, Connie says with a sigh, I want to say, it's just pottery. It's like the Beanie Babies craze. We're just trying to navigate this very strange, very new world of people who are taking it to another level. What is it that makes East Fork's dishware so collectible, so covetable? It is, after all, just simple, unadorned pottery. And yet I've spent hours deliberating over which neutral color to commit to. Panna cotta or eggshell? Which seasonal colors to wait for indefinitely? I need you, Night Swim. And which pieces to buy in which glaze? Should I have cake plates with a pop of color? How many place settings? I pored over East Fork's Instagram account, searching for pairings that I love, and then, when I spot one, I question my original decisions. When I opened my Christmas present and saw my very first East Fork supper plates in creamy panna cotta, I rubbed the edges beneath my fingers. They're thick and full-feeling, soft and matte, smooth. My boyfriend peered over my shoulder before gently running his hand over them, then picking one up. Oh, he said and smiled. Now I get it. Yes, I think the product is good. It has character. It has soul. It's made with materials that have substance, that feel real and tootsome, Alex says. But really, it comes down to Connie's voice and the sincerity with which she speaks to people. We're not a typical direct-to-consumer brand. These companies that feel kind of soulless, we're very, very passionate. Now, 10 years after Alex first fired his hand-built kiln, surrounded by forest and farmland and wood smoke, a dream for the next decade takes shape. A large campus with an apprenticeship program similar to how Alex learned the craft. The Matisses are hoping to replicate the feeling of New Belgium Brewing's Asheville campus, become one of the largest ceramic factories in the United States, which isn't hard since there are only about three of them left, Alex says. They envision a dynamic, vibrant hub where people can visit to learn about pottery, this rich North Carolina tradition, and shop, of course. Now I open my cabinets, and I dream of earthy eggshell creams and pale taro purples and deep night swim blue greens, of weeknight suppers on mismatched plates in front of the TV, and of elegant dinner parties with a perfectly set table, of juice cups small enough for children to wrap their hands around, and mugs in a rainbow of colors for their dad and me to sip from, of something to pass down, of something to build. East Fork is at 15 West Walnut Street in Asheville. EastFork.com. And now, in the remaining time, I'm going to go back to where we left off last time, which was reading a whole series of short articles about the National Registry of Historical Places in North Carolina. And we left off here. We were about to read about Fort Macon at Atlantic Beach, which was completed in 1834. Constructed by the United States military following the War of 1812, Fort Macon was part of a series of fortifications built to defend our country's harbors and ports from foreign invasion. That's my watch. It's decided I said the magic word S-I-R-I or something like that and tells me it's talking to me. I'm sorry. Built in 1861, the fort was occupied by Confederate forces in preparation for a Union attack. On March 23rd, 1892, Colonel Moses J. White, the fort's commander, refused to surrender to Brigadier General John G. Park. A month later, Park and Major General Ambrose Burnside's forces laid siege to the fort, and in only a few hours, the masonry walls were cracked. By the following day, the Union Army controlled the fort, and they continued to hold it for the remainder of the war. The fort was used as a prison during Reconstruction. It was manned once again during the Spanish-American War, then abandoned in 1903. In 1924, the site was deeded to the state and became the second state park. Fort Macon experienced one last military hurrah during World War II when the Coast Artillery Corps occupied the park for defense against German U-boats. And there's a picture here. You can see the central fortification and a moat around it. I don't know that it was filled with water, but it looks like a moat, and then you go up a ramp from there to the area where the armaments were placed. Of course, everything is nice and grassy green now. And there's a tall flag post with an American flag atop. It said at Fort Macon State Park, visitors can watch cannon and musket demonstrations, see restored living quarters, and explore in and around the fort. And that's right at the end, the eastern end of Atlantic Beach. Somerset Place State Historic Site in Cresswell. It was active 1785 to 1865. Located in Washington County, Somerset Place originally consisted of more than 100,000 acres, making it one of the largest plantations in the Upper South. After being purchased by three Edenton businessmen, the land's densely wooded, swampy terrain was converted into high-yielding fields of rice, corn, oats, wheat, beans, peas, and flax. During its 80 years as an active plantation, Somerset place profited from the labor of more than 850 enslaved men, women, and children, who made it one of the state's most prosperous plantations until the abolition of slavery in 1865. These days, guided tours offer visitors an honest view of life on a former plantation during its operating years. Brunswick Town, Fort Anderson, Winnebago, established in 1725. Maurice Moore, the first in his family to live in North Carolina, founded Brunswick Town in 1725. He designated plots of land for a church, courthouse, graveyard, marketplace, and several other public buildings. Some of the permanent settlers were sons or daughters of Barbadian planters. The town grew slowly, and residents formed a plantation community based on land and trade. In 1861, construction of a fort was planned to protect the lower Cape Fear from attack by sea. After the fall of Fort Fisher, Fort Anderson was the area's sole means of defense. The historic site now functions as a museum and park. Portsmouth Village, Portsmouth Island, established 1753. Although now a ghost town, Portsmouth Village was once the Outer Banks' most prosperous settlement and one of the busiest ports on the East Coast. The town was established in 1753 and quickly became the largest European settlement on the Outer Banks. Benefiting from North Carolina's booming shipping industry of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. In 1842, more than two-thirds of the state's exported goods passed through Ocracoke Inlet by way of Portsmouth. Following the Civil War, however, the shipping industry dwindled from nearly 700 in 1860 to merely two residents who left the village in 1971. Since then, it's been maintained by the National Park Service and currently serves as an attraction for visitors who arrive by boat. All we see here is a little yellow house, a dock in good condition, and what looks like it could be an outhouse or it could be a pump house and some sort of a storage facility, also painted yellow in the yard. Lastly, St. Peter and Paul Russian Orthodox Greek Catholic Church in St. Helena, built in 1932. When it was built in 1932, Saints Peter and Paul were the only Russian Orthodox church in North Carolina. Today, the chapel's Byzantine-style gold dome, topped with a traditional Orthodox triple-barred cross, immediately sets it apart from the many Baptist and Methodist churches in Pender County. Located in the village of St. Helena, Saints Peter and Paul, few remaining congregants are direct descendants of Elias DeBelo, one of the many Ukrainian immigrants who were among the church's first members. It's just a little brick building here, about two stories high, with high windows on the side and nicely kept shrubs around the edge. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I certainly hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.